from KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about a new documentary that tells the backstory behind the legal case to overturn the ban over same-sex marriage in Utah. The film explores the role of the Mormon Church in this story, the inability of the state's legal team to make its case for the ban. But what's really interesting and new is the story of the brash and unlikely activist Mark Lawrence, who really got the case going, then refused to back down. The film is called Church and State. We'll be right back.
Hey there, podcast listener. I'm Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. If you enjoy the show, we'd appreciate it if you did us a little favor. Find us on the iTunes store and leave us a review. Let us know what you think. It's valuable feedback for us, and frankly, the more reviews we have, the more listeners we can attract. Thanks in advance. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the show.
This is Radio West, and Doug Fabrizio. There's a lot going on in the new documentary film Church and State. It's about the legal case to overturn Utah's gay marriage ban back in 2013, a case, by the way, no one expected would go anywhere. But then, of course, on December 20th of that year, it did. Federal Judge Robert Shelby stunned everyone by ruling the ban unconstitutional. And, of course, as you know by now, it sent dozens of couples to courthouses around the state to get married. So the film is about that. It's about the personal stories of the plaintiffs in the case. It's about the personal story of the lead attorney in the case. It's about the inability of the Utah legal team to make its own case for the ban and how completely unprepared they were for Judge Shelby's ruling. It's about the history of the LDS Church and its opposition to same-sex marriage. It's about the influence of the church on the state. But the film is also a profile of a brilliant and kind of tragic figure, a man named Mark Lawrence, who had the audacity to put together the legal team to challenge the Utah ban. He's a man whose grit and abrasiveness fueled the effort, but that same grit also alienated him from the team and from the larger marriage equality movement, and it may have kept him from recognizing his own success. The film, again, is called Church and State. It's opening at the Broadway Center Cinemas this week. We'll give you some more details about that as we go along. But today in the program, we're talking about the film with Holly Tuckett, who co-directed and co-produced it. She's a documentary and narrative film producer and cinematographer based here in Salt Lake City. Her company, Flying Hat Productions, has produced more than 35 documentaries, music videos, and other projects. And Holly Tuckett, welcome to you.
Thank you, Doug.
And also with us is the co-director and co-producer of the film, Kendall Wilcox. You may know him as a documentary filmmaker and Mormon LGBT activist. He's working on a project called Far Between, which explores what it means to be gay and Mormon. He's also co-founder of Mormons Building Bridges. And welcome back to you, Kendall. Welcome. Thanks for joining us. Holly, let me start with you. Your relationship with this idea, because it seems like you've talked about when Mark Lawrence, and we'll get into who a little bit more in terms of who Mark Lawrence is. We actually had him on this program before. But when he first came to you with this idea that, hey, I'm doing this thing, I'm going to challenge this ban, what was your gut reaction to it?
Well, I was working with another producing partner, and I had been working on a narrative film where everybody was kind of volunteering their time, trying to raise the money to get the film made. And it was a time where I was like, okay, I don't know if I can take on any more projects for free right now. And B, when we met him at a coffee shop and sat down with him, he explained what he was doing and talked about the fact that he was taking care of his father who had Alzheimer's and living in his parents' basement. And as a gay ex-Mormon, the thought that anyone would try to toss over the Amendment 3 ban on same-sex marriage.
While all this other stuff is going on
while
in your
other,
life.
While other stuff is going on in your life, it's kind of like I was like being cordial with him. Yeah. And
good luck with that.
Good luck. And yeah. And yeah, we'll come up with a budget. I'll present a budget to your board. And we did that. And I remember walking away from the coffee shop, and I looked at my buddy and I said, dude, this would be amazing, but it's Utah.
Yep.
This isn't happening. And he's never going to raise the money. He's never going to raise the money to pay for the case, let alone pay us to be able to produce a documentary. And so,
you had your own doubts. I mean, so that's
absolutely.
Where,
yeah. I mean,
like everybody else in the film.
Absolutely.
Or a lot of the other people in the
100%
film.
100% yep. Like everybody else in the film. There is no freaking way that he's going to succeed in turning over gay marriage. Church is too powerful. State is too powerful. You know, we're the minority.
Yeah. Kendall, what about this story appealed to you? What was it about this? Because, and as we'll talk about, and as I sort of mentioned in the introduction, there's a lot going on. There are all these kinds of strands going on. I think Mark's story ties it all together in some ways. But what was the part that really got to you, that made you want to be involved?
I got involved really just on December 20th, when Judge Shelby's ruling came. I had been literally locked up in my bedroom for, I think, like 3 months, and like my, you know, latest bout of depression. Literally hadn't left the room. But then when I saw the news, something about it like was the thing that kicked my butt. And I just said, I need to pick up a camera and go document, because that's what you do, right? So in a sense, there was all this sort of personal existential stuff going on for me. And I just started filming. And then a mutual friend was also sort of had the same instinct. And so he was filming as well. And it just sort of evolved out of that. And I didn't even meet Mark. I don't know how long it took to meet Mark, because, again, I was introduced just through the ruling. And so my main instinct was just, somebody's got to be documenting this. Yeah. And may not be me, but I'll get some footage and share it with somebody and we'll see what happens.
Mark Lawrence says early on in the film, people deserve to know the whole story. What does he mean by that?
Well, I think that...
he says that with a little bit of edge to his voice, by the way. A little bit of it.
It's the first line I think you hear in the film.
Yeah. I think for Mark, he really, at the point when we interviewed him and he said that statement, it had been a long time in between when marriage was legal here and when we did that interview. And so there was a narrative that the community believed, and that narrative was that Derek Kitchen was responsible for the case, that he and Moody, Cody and Laurie were all the activists in a sense that
I'll just mention
it.
These are the plaintiffs in the case: Moody Sabaiti and Derek Kitchen and Laurie Wood.
Yes.
And
Kate Call and Karen, her partner.
Yeah, and Cody Partridge. Yeah.
And Cody Partridge, Laurie's partner.
Sorry, I didn't want to distract you.
Yeah.
Keep going. Yeah.
So
there's this kind of myth that he is thinking, that there's this myth out there that...
Yeah.
And it makes sense. I mean, it is Kitchen versus Herbert.
Yeah, you know, so that's the name. Yeah.
And I think that there was a time where some of the community realized that Mark and Restore Our Humanity, his organization, that the nonprofit that was raising money to help pay for the legal case, there was a point where people did know about him. But as we move forward in time to where the case is becoming more and more a news story, Mark's organization and himself sort of become a lost footnote.
Yeah.
And so I think he was, when he makes that statement, he's bitter.
Yeah.
He's bitter.
That's what's so interesting about the film. Again, there are a lot of elements and we'll get to some of them, but this particular one, I called him a tragic figure in some ways. Does that seem right?
Oh, yeah. Throughout the editing process, we called it, you know, almost like on the level of a Shakespearean tragic figure. He had this tragic flaw that was the thing that fueled him into it. But then...
That's the grit and the
warrior spirit, as Peggy puts it,
yeah.
which was necessary, right? And lots of figures throughout history have had that. But then when it became more of this case that was in the public arena, and you had to sort of play nice with all the figures and win both in the court, the legal court, and the court of public opinion, other people were saying, hey, that warrior spirit doesn't play well here.
Yeah.
And
don't be so loud. Don't be so abrasive. You need to be, temper your idea. And he wasn't having it.
No.
Describe him a bit. I mean, he's amazing, I have to say, in a lot of ways. He's just gutsy. He's abrupt. But he's also incredibly impatient. Mm-hmm. Doesn't like being told what to do.
Absolutely.
Doesn't want to follow any kind of conventional path. And in some ways, this is what the film is about, too. It sort of gets at where he's coming from.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a little bit about that.
Mark's persona, I mean, the first time I met him, I was like, okay, here's this dude. It's middle of spring, and he's wearing this leather jacket, and he's got, a tattoo that basically runs from the back of his head down his neck to, and then his arms are full of tats.
An unassuming sort
and,
of
and he literally wears his heart on his – he doesn't mince words. He says what he thinks. And he is extremely passionate about people and fairness. And he wants change to happen. And you're right. He's totally impatient. He doesn't want to wait.
I want to play a moment from the film because it seems to get at what drives him now. And I'm not sure this was entirely clear to you or any of you right at the beginning. What really seems to have driven him to try to challenge Utah's Amendment 3 and this ban, what kind of was a sense of regret or guilt about not being active in the gay rights cause during the AIDS crisis of the 1980s. This is something that he talks about here in the film. Here's a moment.
I watched people die in San Francisco. I watched ACT UP. I just stood off the sidelines, though. I didn't do anything. I just watched. I would look at that and go, why can't I do that? Why am I not out there marching with them? Those people have got a lot of guts and they have a lot of courage, and maybe I was afraid. But it would have given me a hell of a lot more meaning if I had known I could be down there marching with those people and sticking with them instead of reading about it in the paper.
What does he mean? What kept him, do you think, from being engaged? Because this seemed to drive him. He's like, this time this is my chance. I've got to get in there now. But what kept him, do you think? Do you think you understand that now at the time? Just circumstance?
In that interview, we pressed him on, what kept you? And he said, he just kept going back to, well, it's just not what I did. I wasn't there to do that. I was there to, in a sense, almost like, keep pushing the boundaries from what he had experienced back here in Utah, growing up here and gay. And he was more invested in that lifestyle, not to, improperly use that term in this context, but he was more invested in just, I'm going to be gay, I'm going to enjoy it. I don't need to be this activist person because, in a sense, he'd already sort of done his personal private activism back home.
Yeah.
And so that's what he was
by leaving Mormonism, essentially.
Yeah, and just sort of surviving back in Utah, in Sandy, Utah. So he was just invested in that. So, and it wasn't until he had come back to Utah, we weren't able to include a lot of his life story back here in Utah once he had come back and found a partner, was very much in love, and just sort of one tragedy after another kept hitting his life. And he alludes to that just a little bit at the very, very beginning, where he says, I've basically come back from the dead.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that gave him literally a new lease on life and a new perspective that, wait, I'm going to make this time count.
Yeah.
And so he went for it.
He had cancer in 2010, came out of that experience, as he put it, different. Like that changed him too. Mm-hmm. So you get the sense of how intense he can be and how maddening he can be, probably, to work with too, right? Mm-hmm. He's like, he's not going to compromise.
Mm-hmm. No, he definitely is not a compromiser.
And, it's even ran through when he talks about not caring about AIDS, in San Francisco at the time, sort of hearing about it, knowing about it. But he's like, I want my rite of passage. I want to be able to go out and have sex with whoever I want and make those risks because, in a sense, we've fought for this ability to have that, take that, those risks.
Yeah.
And I think that's continued to run through his life about, like, damn it, I'm going to take risks.
Yeah. I also kind of feel like he had something to prove mm-hmm. to people back here.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the way that he talks about, I'm going to have sex with whoever I want. You mm-hmm. can tell in the way that he's saying that, that going to San Francisco was for him like putting a stake in the ground and saying, I'm gay, I'm going to be successful, and screw you guys for doubting me.
To put it lightly.
Like, yeah. I think that there were a lot of people who were trying to stop him from going.
Yeah.
And I think that he was afraid maybe to get involved in the movement because it would somehow thwart his success. Because he was a really, really successful. He worked in the restaurant business for a while he was there. He moved up the ranks and managed a restaurant and was making good money and, you know, was a success.
Was headed somewhere.
Yes, was headed somewhere.
Yeah.
And I just want to say, too, we conducted several interviews with him, and it wasn't until that last big interview that we did when he finally shared this sort of this backstory motivation.
Yeah.
And you know, Holly was the one that kept pushing and saying, we gotta keep asking him, like, why are you doing this? Because we asked him that many times.
He didn't have a lot to say about
it. And it was all, you know, he was verbose about, like, justice and doing the right thing and somebody's got to do it and the underdog. And it was great. Good rhetoric. But we were like, but why are you doing it? And he's like, because I believe. And we finally kept pushing. And then in that last interview, he gave up that backstory.
Yeah.
So fast forward now. When he wants to put together this team to challenge this band, which seems like completely ridiculous and audacious sort of thing. And it all begins, as you say in the film, as a kind of a discussion group on Facebook. And just this conversation that he's having, they go to coffee shops and talk about, and it seems ridiculous. And here's a moment when, again, he's not going to take no for an answer. And he starts to try to get some interest from larger groups, like, as he mentions here, the ACLU. So you'll hear Mark Lawrence in this clip. You'll also hear Kate Call, by the way, one of the plaintiffs in the suit. Here's another moment from Church and State.
I contacted Mark on the comment board and said, I'm interested, when and where. We thought it was crazy and there was no way in hell it would happen, except we were going to try. None of us had PR experience. None of us had experience in legislation, in fundraising, certainly. We just had will.
And I started contacting community leaders and saying, well, you know, let's do this. And they couldn't get on board with it. And that really, really pissed me off.
He contacted the ACLU, was one, and a number of other groups. And look, you can't blame people for reacting that way, right? I mean, Holly, it's kind of the way you were reacting.
Yeah. I mean, it's Utah. So Kendall and I watched what was that name of that film that we watched that was about the marriage equality movement?
Yeah, Freedom to Marry.
Freedom to Marry.
Yeah.
So it was all about Evan Wolfson.
The godfather of
the gay marriage movement. And in the movie, there's a scene where he's standing in front of this map of the United States and all the states where they're actively lobbying to get laws changed in favor of gay marriage.
What's Utah like? What's the Utah? There wasn't one.
There wasn't anything.
Yeah. Right.
There wasn't anything. Yeah. I mean, even afterwards, when we were kind of going through archival and doing things, there was a Vox video that we watched that was like a quick chronology of the time frame of when people first started fighting for marriage equality, and then when the Obergefell decision was made.
Yeah.
And there was so many states that were flashing by, and it was showing like the year, and then it was like months, right? Because when Utah's marriage ban was overturned, it was like throwing accelerant on a fire. because finally a federal judge had given the language that other states needed in order to turn over their bans. And so,
but no one thought Utah would be the place.
No, and even in that Vox video, I don't even...
It just skipped.
It just skipped us.
But yeah, even the noted, the celebrated Nate Silver, statistician, back in the day when we all liked him and trusted him, he placed Utah second to last, ahead of Mississippi, but second to last, based on all his data. And that was the conventional wisdom at the time.
Yeah, we weren't supposed to do it.
Yeah. Holly Tuckett is with us, and Kendall Wilcox, co-directors and co-producers of the documentary film. It's called Church and State. It opens this Thursday night at the Broadway Center Cinemas in downtown Salt Lake City. We have a link to all of this on our website for showtimes. We should also mention that next Wednesday night, that's July 18th, there's going to be a Q&A following the 7 o'clock screening. Again, go to our website for the particulars. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West from KUER.
Benjamin Franklin said, "Tell me and I forget. Teach me and I may remember. Involve me and I learn." That sums up KUER's community calendar pretty well. You'll learn new things, like how to make your own honey, or write a story, or arrange flowers. There are new events every week, and if you've got something you want to show people, you can post your own events too. Check out the community calendar under the events tab at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about a new documentary that tells the backstory behind the legal case to overturn the ban on same-sex marriage in Utah. And the film explores the role of the Mormon Church in the story, the inability of the Utah legal team to make its case for the ban. But what's really new and interesting about the film is the story of the brash and unlikely activist, a man by the name of Mark Lawrence, who really got the case going. He built this ragtag legal team, but then he refused to defer to national organizations or really temper his rhetoric or language. The film is called Church and State. It's opening this week at the Broadway Center Cinemas in Salt Lake City. We'll give you the details about that a little bit later on the program. Joining us today, co-producers and co-directors of the film, Holly Tuckett and Kendall Wilcox. So let's talk about the strand of the film that really digs into the Mormon Church and its influence. That's gets to the title, Church and State, of course, in big part. Kendall, let me start with you. What did you learn about the influence of the LDS Church on state affairs? I mean, there's this presumption that, and Steve Urquhart will mention a former lawmaker who really does say it in pretty clear terms that the Mormon Church has a powerful influence, which is kind of a no-duh sort of thing for a lot of people. But talk a little bit about that part, the relationship between church and state, because it's a theme in the film.
Once the Kitchen Case lawsuit was submitted to the Supreme Court for review and was sort of kicked back down, it changed the trajectory of our plans as storytellers. To say, okay, so it's not going to be the case that changes the nation, right? Which we were sort of banking on, you know? That's why we got into it to a degree. We realized, okay, if we're going to keep telling this story, what can we capitalize on in terms of what sets this particular battle for same-sex marriage in the United States apart from every single other story? Because we knew there's filmmakers all across the country, let's be honest, following their particular cases, because at that time there were
lots of
30
them.
40 cases.
Yeah.
And so we, you know, we very quickly landed on, okay, it's the fact that it's taking place here in Utah, and what's most unique about Utah is the role of the LDS Church in everything. And so we wanted to be able to, you know, tell the story truthfully, factually, fairly, but honestly. Mm-hmm. And so we set about to do that.
I think it's interesting the way you talk about in the film, as someone points out, the LDS Church, they become defenders of religious freedom.
Yeah.
and from their earliest history. Mm-hmm. And you dig into the history a bit there. And as the reporter Jennifer Doudna explains in the film, the federal government is not going to allow Utah to become a state. Mm-hmm. As long as, of course, they're practicing polygamy. That's obvious. But also as long as religion remains at the center of public life. Mm-hmm. So the church basically has to make this compromise. And I think we all know that story, but it's an important element of the film. You know, Mormons sacrificed this part of their faith, mm-hmm. and it has a powerful impact on the way Mormons think about persecution. And so it just adds another wrinkle to this story, yeah. I think.
And what we wanted to do in particular was talk about that particular aspect of it, because again, what sets this story apart from even, you know, in Baltimore, for example, the Catholic Church is everywhere too. So some people actually push back against this, saying, well, it's not that unique. Every area of the country might have its dominant culture and religion. So what's unique about the Mormon experience, right? So that was good feedback. It pushed us to go deeper.
Yeah.
To really talk about this moment in time, this period that, frankly, we think, and we tried to make that impression in the film, it becomes this sort of existential psychological identity aspect of the Mormonism of Utah, this sense of this a bit of a persecution complex, and to push past the easy sort of almost sarcastic irony that everybody else was pointing out about, like, oh, of all places, Utah is
quote unquote traditional marriage.
Exactly. Yeah. Is pushing for traditional marriage when, you know, they fought and lost for their right to practice polygamy. Yeah. So who are they to tell others? And we're like, okay, yeah, fair point. But let's push past that and get to, no, you don't understand. Like, it is psychologically in the heart of part of what it means to be Mormon is this sort of persecution complex. We've been pushed around on the issue of marriage, so of course there's irony, and we're not going to let it happen again.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
To me and to us as filmmakers, that was what we really wanted to capitalize and get across to help people say, like, no, it's not like anywhere else. It goes way deeper than that.
Way, way deeper. I think for me, because Kendall's way more versed in the LDS church, and I left when I was 18, and just because I could not cope with the hypocrisy that I felt the church presented for me. And I was telling Kendall as we were doing research and pulling out visuals for this section of the film, all of the political cartoons and things that were made during that time. And I mean, as a small child, everybody knows, you know, that Joseph Smith was a martyr. But I don't think that even as an adult, I didn't understand what that really meant for not just Joseph Smith, but all Mormons, and the level of hatred that was basically leveled against them was immense. I mean, it was just that to me was like a huge, for lack of a better term, revelation. As we were researching for the film.
There's this section I want to talk about because there's, I have to say, some kind of remarkable moments from general conference talks, one particular memorable one, which we'll get to, from Boyd K. Packer, which is kind of jaw-dropping. But set this up for us, Kendall, or help us. So there's this major, as you say in the film, there's this major transition that happens after World War II. And it's not just Mormons who are thinking this, but Mormons start to see, as someone points out in the film, homosexuality as this psychological condition. And that gets us into this period in Mormonism that you talk about that was really driven in part by Spencer Kimball. Spencer W. Kimball, who was a beloved prophet of Mormonism and also incredibly outspoken. I didn't realize how outspoken he was in his opposition to homosexuality. Basically, in his writings and his speeches, he sees homosexuality as just particularly awful and evil. Let me play another moment from the film. This is a part where we'll hear Spencer Kimball, and then also one of the sources from in the documentary, a Professor Taylor Petrie, talking about – you'll hear Spencer Kimball and Taylor Petrie. And it gives you a sense of how Kimball and others were thinking about it in the – I guess this was in the 70s.
Yes.
Yeah.
The minister quoted is reported to have said, two people of the same sex can express love and deepen that love by sexual intercourse. Those are ugly voices. They're loud and raspy. To the great Moses, these perversions were an abomination and a defilement, worthy of death.
The idea that someone is gay is an idea that Elder Kimball strongly rejected. He believed that homosexuals who were telling the story were perpetuating a satanic lie. And he's trying to teach people to train their minds through a set of practices like singing hymns, exercising. So his program of self-mastery is the cure to same-sex desires.
This is so interesting, and there's this this instructional video that you include, or excerpts from it, which uses as the sort of principal metaphor whitewater rapids.
Yeah, yeah.
We just talk a little bit about this, because I actually want to play a section from this. I find it really interesting, because Spencer Kimball makes this connection between masturbation as kind of this gateway sin to leading to homosexuality. And this was – they created this video about it, and this was part of the regular rhetoric, I guess, at the time.
At least for him. Just to give a tiny bit more background, you know, he was assigned by President David O. McKay in the late 50s, actually, all the way back in the 50s, as a pretty new apostle. Him and Marquis Peterson were assigned all sexual sins, basically, to research, understand, and sort of be in charge of. And then out of that grew, of course, his desire to understand and minister. And, you know, in all sincerity to him, minister to those who were laboring under this habit of homosexuality. And I don't think we can overemphasize the importance of the mindset that was going on between the 50s, 60s, 70s that he was enthralled in about trying to understand the evolution from seeing homosexuality as a behavior, a choice of just this, I'm bored or I want to sin sort of thing, so I'm going to do homosexuality. It's a behavioral choice, into starting to evolve into, okay, well, it goes deeper than that. Okay, we'll concede that, but it's a sickness, right? It's a psychological malady, a pathology that, again, if you engage in the right kind of behaviors, you will dig out of your psyche that sickness, and you will then be able to become your true heterosexual self and be redeemed from your sins. And so that process of evolution of thinking was embedded in President Kimball's thinking, in his research. He did rely on some of the best research, quote unquote, at the time.
Yeah.
You know, we quote in the film from a Columbia University professor who President Kimball cited in his research that he later wrote in things like Miracle of Forgiveness, his book all about, the miracle of forgiveness, mostly from sexual sin. And this thinking that it is a psychological malady that through behavioral changes you could free yourself from.
Was this instructional video, that the excerpts, was this shown widely throughout the church?
Yeah, and it was targeted at youth.
Yeah.
Because the understanding was that youth could be, groomed. You know, there was all that kind of thinking and languaging around homosexuality, recruited by adults who prey upon them, get them engaged in this behavior. And once you get into the behavior, then become addicted, and then it's the psychological malady.
Yeah.
Masturbation, or rather common indiscretion, is not approved of the Lord, nor of his church.
That's like playing in the rapids. When you're in the whitewater, things can happen fast.
Masturbation is the introduction to the more serious sins of exhibitionism and the gross sin of homosexuality. I hope fervently that I am making clear the position of the Lord and his church on these unmentionable practices.
So he set me on my journey down the river.
River is the big theme, the rapids in this. This leads us to another moment, and I've often heard, and I think a lot of people have heard of Boyd K. Packer. He was a member of the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles for a long time. And it seems like he sort of takes on Kimball and yes. Peterson's mantle for trying to fight this idea that homosexuality is a biological reality. That mm-hmm. He says it's the idea that it's anything other than this choice is a malicious and destructive lie. That's what mm-hmm. he talks about. He did that really throughout his ministry, yes. I think. And the film tells of this moment in a speech of Packer's. This was back when? Do you know when?
This was in the late 70s.
Late 70s.
76.
Where one missionary had made a sexual advance. He'd heard this story Packer mm-hmm. had.
A missionary came to him and
came
confessed.
To him and confessed. That, yeah. Yeah. And he beat the crap out of him.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The missionary who was confessing was the one who had been the object of the pass. And the way he tells the story is that the missionary is contrite and he's afraid to confess that he's done something, and President Packer doesn't know quite what it was, and then he confesses, "Oh, I beat up my companion because he made a pass at me," and well, you'll play the clip of how he reacts.
My response was, "Well, thanks. Somebody had to do it, and it wouldn't." And it wouldn't be well for a general authority to solve a problem in that way. Now, I'm not recommending that course to you, my young friends, but I'm not omitting it. You must... you must protect yourselves.
Where did you find that? Was it hard to find? Was it easy? I've never heard it before. I'd heard of it.
So after he gave that talk, it was turned into a pamphlet, actually. And the pamphlet was widely used by bishops and stake presidents in counseling people who, quote unquote, suffered from same-sex attraction. So I had been exposed to it my whole adult life. And in my own research for the other project, Far Between, had been trying to find the video footage through church archives, and it just wasn't available. And in my sort of naive mind thought, oh, well, it's because they realize how horrible it is, and so they're not going to release it. And actually, it was Holly who, you know, in our archive list was like, okay, I got to search for this and that. And all of a sudden, it was available on the LDS.org website. And she actually called me. She's like, get into the editing room. We found the footage. I was like, no way.
Yeah.
And they had it.
Yeah. You know, Kendall said, there's this talk by Boyd K. Packer. We've got to find it. And I kept digging and digging, and I almost feel like, because the church has been like upping their website game mm-hmm. and like putting all their videos online, and you know they're downloadable and you can share them, and you know I think they're using them so that Mormons around the world can spread the word, right? And just one day, it was there, and I downloaded it. Because I knew if I didn't download it, it might be a problem. We mm-hmm. might not ever find it again. Mm-hmm. And I started listening to it and got to the part that Kendall had told me about. And I almost started crying because it was so, you know, he's just egging the crowd on. It's one thing to read the mm-hmm. text, but it's another thing to watch him and listen to the crowd, and it's like almost like he's feeding off of it, and he's enjoying the response that he's getting. And you know, everybody's always talking about how this talk condoned violence, but it really shows how he himself felt, because you see how he reacts to the crowd.
Yeah, I have to say, like, even hearing it again today, and I've watched it.
Chills.
Countless times, it hurts every single time. And again, having read it my whole adult life in print, like Holly was saying, it's very different because you don't get the laughter in print. You don't get the expression on his face that you see in video. And as a gay Mormon, just trying to countenance and understand a group of people who, oh, these men of God, you know, gathered together in the spirit of trying to be good, righteous followers of Jesus Christ, and then laughing at the notion of violence towards gay people. I don't think I'll ever get over it, and I don't want to.
Yeah.
And not to be hyperbolic or inappropriate in my comparisons, but every time I hear it and I see it, I'm reminded of like the confusion that I feel when I see like those postcards from like lynchings and things in the South, and there's all these white people gathered around with smiles, and there's little kids smiling and laughing. And again, I want to be really careful. I'm not comparing the two, but just my utter confusion as a human being trying to understand how somebody can stand over a dead body and laugh and smile. It reminds me of that every time, and it hurts every time.
Yeah.
We need to head to a break, but I want to bring us sort of up to the modern perspective of the LDS Church, which you deal with. This is not just in the past, of course. Dallin Oaks, who's now in the LDS First Presidency, has, as someone puts it in the film, drawn up the playbook for this modern fight regarding same-sex marriage. And Oaks being worried about the normalization of homosexuality, those kinds of things. Kendall, just say something briefly about this proclamation of the family, a proclamation to the world, because this is a document that Professor Petry describes as a political document, and it's an important part, I think, of the modern story.
Oh, it's vital. It's key. And I do want to – I just feel like I want to say we did share – a few edits of this film with representatives of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, just in the spirit of fair game and trying to, you know, get their comment throughout. We solicited many times their comments. And once we had included these last couple of quotes that we had talked about from Kimball and Packer and Oaks, the response was, well, I mean,
we wish you didn't do that.
I wish you didn't, because, you know, we've been better in recent years. And I had to say, yeah, we can debate the relative term better, but you haven't taken the steps to redeem yourself from that history, and that history is entrenched in the minds and hearts of Mormons, and they continue to think of homosexual people in that same way. You have not done enough to redeem yourself from that. And so as filmmakers, it's our job to hold you accountable, let people understand that history. So I just wanted to sort of put that out there. But yes, I mean, there's so much to talk about with the proclamation of the family, but long story short, there was a case in Hawaii, if that's what we're talking about, in Hawaii in 1993.
That really gets the ball rolling in terms of the church's involvement.
Yeah,
it
woke up
fights.
The church in realizing, whoa, there is a possibility of legalization of same-sex marriage in the country. We can't let that stand because of the church got very involved. That's when they really began investing in it. And as a product of all of that, there's a lot of minutia we could get into, but as a product of all that, they issued this document, a proclamation to the world on the family, and it is taken as revelation by the majority of very Orthodox members of the church that this is God speaking through his prophets about family is central to the Mormon doctrine.
All right, here's another strand we should talk about in the film, which is really interesting, and it's something that I'm not sure it had occurred to a lot of people, and that is the case made by the state, or not made that well by the state, it's something you get into. They were not ready for
Shelby
ruling at all. I mean, they were completely taken aback by it and didn't have a stay prepared. There's a clip I want to play here in a moment with Peggy Tomsic, who's the lead attorney, of course, in the case, in this telephone conversation she has. Maybe you could set this up with us, but this is another strand in the film where you talk about how Utah was just absolutely not really ready legally.
No. Right. No, they weren't ready.
Well, they had the same mindset as everybody else, right? Of like, oh, what a ridiculous lawsuit. It'll never win here. We're just fine.
We're fine. No judge is ever going to disagree with how we all think and feel in Utah, which is gay people shouldn't be married.
And the state has the right to
dictate. The state has the right to tell that constitutionally.
And we should explain, too, that a stay, just for, you know, in layman's terms, a stay means that even though the judge issues a ruling, a stay would mean that the ruling doesn't take effect until a higher court makes its decision.
Yeah.
And but in order for that to happen, one side has to issue a motion or submit a motion to the judge to say, hey, whatever your decision, we want to stay on your decision so it doesn't take effect immediately.
It's a procedural bit of business.
Yeah.
You just file it.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
the state didn't.
The state didn't.
No, they did not.
And there was endless speculation about, like, really?
Really?
Why?
And,
but the conventional wisdom was because they just knew that they were going to win.
Yeah.
So why would you put a stay when you're going to win?
Let me play a moment. This is interesting. This is Peggy Tomsic again, the lead lawyer in the case. And her personal story, which we won't get into necessarily, is an important part of the story as well. What's motivating her, obviously, her same-sex relationship and her wanting to adopt a son and all of that plays out as well. But she talks about this exchange they have between the state lawyer and Judge Shelby. Here's another moment from the film, Church and State.
So I drive back to the office and go in, and Judge Shelby's office calls and said, Judge Shelby wants to get you and the state lawyer on the line. What's your question? He goes, well, we don't understand your decision. What do you mean you don't understand my decision? Well, there's nothing in there saying you're staying your decision, and we understand people are getting married. And I said, I understand that too, Your Honor. He said, you didn't file a motion to ask me to stay my decision. You tell me when you will file your motion for a stay, and I'll immediately hold a hearing. And the lawyer for the state goes, I don't know what we're going to do. And Judge Shelby goes, well, I guess there's nothing I can do for you then. Good day.
Such an odd turn of events. And we should explain, if people don't remember the context, there was a lot of turmoil in the Attorney General's office, which doesn't necessarily excuse it, but it may explain it a bit.
Yeah. I mean, John Swallow was just being indicted, and they were in transition. Sean Reyes wasn't even Attorney General yet. There was an acting Attorney General.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, you know, the AG's office wouldn't really sit down with us until everything was all said and done. And then they sent their communications director.
Yeah. And the Solicitor General.
But and the Solicitor General.
They both were very well rehearsed in their answers.
Yeah. So. And, you know, they just said, you know, we our legal team looked over everything and we did everything that we should have, and, you know.
No regrets.
No regrets. We have no regrets about how we handled the case.
And they blame Judge Shelby for not issuing his own stay.
Yeah.
Right. But that's not a judge's responsibility.
Okay. I want to bring this back around to Mark Lawrence, come back around to this, because, again, and this is a really interesting part of the way he becomes sort of alienated from the team, from the plaintiffs. Again, it's a pretty unsparing portrait of that relationship. It starts to fall apart. And this is an important part of the story, because Mark continues to be outspoken, and maybe in ways others in the team don't think he should be. As Peggy says, and I think, Holly, as you mentioned earlier, he has this warrior mentality, and it wasn't right for the time necessarily. I mean, it's the thing that got them there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But over the course of time, maybe it wasn't the right way to go about it. Let me play another moment finally from Mark, because I want to ask you a question about it from the film Church and State.
And I think that also has a lot to do with why I got involved in this damn case. It's been a good distraction. When you look at these stories of how sweet everything was, bullshit. We were almost at one point like a little family, and now we're enemies. Somebody asked me, would you do it over again? I don't think I would.
Do you believe that?
He still holds to it.
Does he?
He does. Yeah. We've done a few different interviews, and he still says that he doesn't think that he would do it again.
I don't believe him. I mean, I think that he's angry that it didn't work out the way he wanted to, but he made a difference.
Absolutely.
From a certain perspective, and I get that he's angry about
but,
it.
But I think it is important. That's why we left that comment in there, because we actually debated about, like,
oh, yeah,
really?
We debated for, like...
Yeah, yeah, well,
but,
of course. Yeah,
but to me and to us, you know, it demonstrated the depth of his hurt, the depth of his sense of alienation from what he thought was this family of activists working together. And,
right.
You know, and he was at the helm, you know, he was the dad of the family. And then to be so isolated, which really he was, and we tried to find enough visual evidence also in the filmmaking of... to show this literal separation that we witnessed as we were filming the whole thing of, yeah, going from this community, small, tight community, to like two very, very separate communities.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the pain that he felt because of that, the alienation, it really hurt.
You don't have to give too much away, but do you think they're going to mend fences, these groups?
Cody and Laurie and Peggy and her wife Cindy came to our screening in Palm Springs at the American Documentary Film Festival. And we had hoped that Mark would be able to get there, but he had just taken a new job, which for him, that was huge because he had been unemployed for quite some time. And so he was like, I really want to be there, but I can't. And they spoke highly of Mark in all of the Q&As. They really respect that he was that gritty activist. But, you know, yeah, I don't know. He's still at it, though.
Yeah.
You know, he's still taking on the church. He just was part of a documentary that Vivani Entertainment just put out that is taking on the church. He's still at it.
It's Holly Tuckett, along with Kendall Wilcox. They directed and produced the documentary Church and State, which opens at the Broadway Center Cinemas Thursday night. We have details about all of that on our website, radiowest.org. Kendall, Holly, thank you very much.
Thanks,
Doug.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.